But for the sage, the knowledge of his identity with Brahman is of immense practical importance. He knows it as well and as fully as he knows that he is alive. But this certainly does not mean that in place of himself, other people, houses, stars, hills, and trees, he sees a formless, all-pervasive, and infinite luminosity, which seems to be some people's idea of the divine reality. If such a state of consciousness were possible, it would still be dualistic, involving an utter difference between reality and the ordinary world. It should rather be said that he feels Brahman, the force of the universe, at work in everything he does, thinks, and feels, and this gives a powerful and liberating impulse to his spirit. For he feels free and delivered, which is the precise meaning of Kivalya. He is freed from himself, which is the only thing that ever bound anyone, because he has let himself go. The unenlightened man keeps a tight hold of himself because he is afraid of losing himself. He can trust neither circumstances nor his own human nature. He is terrified of being genuine, of accepting himself as he is, and tries to deceive himself into the belief that he is as he wishes to be. But these are the wishes, the desires that bind him. And it was such desires as these that the Buddha described as the cause of human misery. People imagine that letting themselves go would have disastrous results, trusting neither circumstances nor themselves, which together make up life. They are forever interfering and trying to make their own souls and the world conform with preconceived patterns. This interference is simply the attempt of the ego to dominate life. But when you see that all such attempts are fruitless, and when you relax the fear-born resistance to life in yourself and around you, which is called egoism, you realize the freedom of union with Brahman. In fact, you have always had this freedom, for the state of union with Brahman can neither be attained nor lost. All men and all things have it, in spite of themselves. It can only be realized, which is to say, made real for you, by letting life live you for a while, instead of trying to make yourself live life. You will soon reach the point where you will be unable to tell whether your thoughts and feelings are your own or whether life put them into you. For the distinction between yourself and life will have disappeared. If the truth be known, there never was any distinction, save in our imaginations. This is called union with Brahman, for he that loseth his life shall find it. The Parable of the Cow's Tail. A famous Zen koan asks, "When a cow goes out of its enclosure to the edge of the abyss, its horns and head and its hooves all pass through. But why can't the tail also pass?" Commenting on this, an old master says, "If the cow runs, it will fall into the trench. If it returns, it will be butchered. That little tail is a very strange thing." In the quest for understanding of life, there comes a time when everyone is confronted with that little tail. The one tiny obstacle that stands in the way of complete fulfillment. We know that it is only a fraction of a hair's breadth in the thickness, and yet we feel it as a million miles wide. There is in mathematics an equation which, when drawn as a graph, appears as a curve that always nears but never touches a given line. At first the curve sweeps boldly towards that line, and the head, horns and hoofs go clean through the gate. But just as the tail is about to pass, the curve straightens, leaving just a fraction of an inch between itself and the line. As it moves on, that fraction grows less and less, but still curve and line do not touch. And even though it be continued for 1,000 miles or 1,000,000,000 miles, the gap remains, though at each successive point it becomes smaller. This curve represents the progress of human intellect towards enlightenment, grasping more and more subtle nuances of meaning at each stage of its journey. It is as if we stood bound to illusion by a hair. To weaken it, we split it with the knife of intellect, and split it again until its divisions become so fine that to make its cuts, the mind must be sharpened indefinitely. Yet however much we split this hair, the sum total of its divisions is not a whit thinner than the original hair. For the more fragile we make our bonds, the more is their number. Philosophically, this condition is known as infinite regression, and psychologically, it is that mad, exasperating state that must always precede the final experience of awakening. We can demonstrate this by the famous triangle puzzle of Mahayana philosophy. The two base points of this triangle represent the pairs of opposites which confront us at every moment of our experience, subject and object, I and you, positive and negative, something and nothing. The apex represents the relation, the meaning between them, the principle that gives them reality, the one as distinct from the many. But the moment we set this one apart from the many, we create yet another pair of opposites, thus initiating a process which will continue indefinitely with ever-increasing complications. In the Bhagavad Gita, we are told to stand aside from our thoughts and feelings, to realize that they are not the self, and learn that the self is not the actor in actions, but the spectator of actions. But why not stand aside yet again from this first standing aside, and perceive that it is not the self that stands aside, for the self performs no action? This too may continue forever. The first step in Buddhism is right motive, and to attain enlightenment, it is said that we must do away with selfish desire. But if we have selfish desire in the beginning, surely the desire to get rid of it is also selfish. We desire to be rid of our selfishness for a selfish reason. And again, we may easily have a selfish reason for getting rid of the selfish reason, for wanting to be selfless. An even more fundamental illustration of the problem may be found in the simplest statement of Eastern philosophy, namely, that there is only one reality, and that all diversity is illusion. This is a statement which almost all students of Eastern wisdom take very much for granted. It is the first thing they learn, but in fact, it is almost all there is to learn. For the rest is merely embroidery. It is the central principle of Vedanta, Mahayana, and Taoism alike. There are no two principles in the universe. There is only Brahman, Tathata, or Tao. And enlightenment is just the realization of one's identity with it. But here the complications begin, and the cow's tail gets stuck in the gate. For the moment we think, this is Tao, or that is Tao, we immediately make a distinction between Tao and this and that. Furthermore, as soon as we think that the object of religion is to identify ourselves with the Tao, we create the dualism of the Tao and ourselves that are to be identified with it. Dualism appears the moment we make an assertion or a denial about anything. As soon as we think that this is that or this is not that, we have the distinction between this and that. And even when we say that in reality there are no distinctions, we have the opposition of reality and distinctions. Moreover, let us consider this problem. If there is only Tao, how can there be any divergence from it? If there is only one reality, our thoughts, enlightened or unenlightened, must be it. There can be no distinction between reality and illusion if there is only reality. Whether you can concentrate your thoughts or not, whether they are of compassion or hatred, whether you are thinking about Buddhism or chewing your nails, you cannot by any means diverge from the Tao. You may love life or you may loathe it, yet your loving and loathing are themselves manifestations of life. If you seek union with reality, your very seeking is reality. And how can you say that you have ever lost union? To put it another way, it is said that to be enlightened, we must live in the eternal. Now that infinitely small and therefore infinitely great point of time is called the present moment. The universe exists only in that moment, and it is said that the wise man moves with it, clinging neither to the past nor to the future, making his mind like the mirror that reflects everything instantly as it comes before it. Yet making no effort to retain the reflection when the object is removed. The perfect man, says Chuang Tzu, employs his mind as a mirror. It grasps nothing, it refuses nothing, it receives but does not keep. Yet when the matter is carefully considered, we find that this is a description not of what we should do, but of what we cannot help doing in any case. For whether we think of the past or the future, and whatever we think about either of them, our thoughts exist in and partake of the eternal now. Otherwise, they would not exist at all. We cannot separate ourselves from this present moment, and if we imagine that enlightenment consists simply in living in the present, in thinking only about what is going on now, we find ourselves in the dualism of now and then. The point is that we can only think of what is going on now, even if we are thinking of the past or the future. For our thoughts about past and future are going on now, and we are thinking them. There is only one reality. Therefore, it will be asked, is enlightenment simply to live and think like any ignorant fool, not bothering about philosophy, mysticism, or morality, knowing that whatever you do, you cannot get out of harmony with the Tao? If we answer yes, we assert. If we say no, we deny. The tail is still caught in the gate. But if you think you will attain enlightenment by living like an ignorant fool, you are still caught in the dualism of the you that must attain enlightenment. Indeed, there is no prescription for enlightenment, for as soon as we start saying that it is this or it is not this, we try to make two realities of the universe instead of one. In fact, you can think about philosophy or about eating and drinking. You can love mankind, you can hate it, you can do as you like, you can do as you don't like. You can discipline yourself, you can run wild, you can seek wisdom, you can ignore it, but you can't diverge from the Tao. For everything, anything, and nothing is the Tao. Is it? Be aware of that is. The sting is in the tail. The Second Immortal. Once upon a time, there was a man who lived much as other men live. He had a wife and three children, and a shop in the street of Happy Sparrows, where he sold cakes, vegetables, and sweet pickles. He rose at dawn and went to bed at sunset. He ate rice three times a day. He smoked two pipes of tobacco in the hour. He talked of buying and selling with his neighbors. He picked his teeth after eating and had his wife scratch his back in the noonday heat. In spring, he watched the young grass peeping out from behind the stones. In summer, he lifted an eye at the lazy clouds. In autumn, he followed the leaves that danced in the wind. And in winter, he woke to see the tracks of birds in the snow. And in all seasons, between talking and smoking and selling cakes, he chewed watermelon seeds and amused himself by plaiting straw ropes round his toes. One day, when he went to burn incense at the Temple of Amiable Dragons, his friend the priest approached him, saying, "You are getting on in years, and your eldest son is of an age to take care of your shop. It would not be proper for a man such as you to spend the rest of your days in empty activities, for you will go to your grave as insignificantly as old refuse is flung into the river." "Such being the lot of man," answered the cake seller, "how can I complain?" "So many are mere vegetables," said the priest. "But if you are willing to take the trouble, you can find yourself a place among the immortals."
"And who," asked the cake seller, "are the immortals?"
"They are those who do not depend on their own power to keep themselves alive. Man is a small creature whose life is like a snowflake. But the wind blows on forever, the sun and moon eternally maintain their courses, and the rivers have flowed since time began. The immortals are they who learn the secrets of these things. Instead of relying on their own resources, they allow themselves to be maintained and directed by that which maintains and directs the wind, the sun, the moon, and the rivers."
"But how can I become immortal?"
"You will have to find an immortal to teach you," said the priest. "I am not wise enough."
"Well," said the cake seller, "I must find one. But there are so many people in the world, and how can one recognize an immortal?"
"That should not be difficult," answered the priest. "It is said that their breath is operated by the wind, that the sun gives them the light of the right eye, and the moon of the left, that their shouting is assisted by the thunder, their whispering by the murmuring waves, and their laughter by the mountain streams. The earth, it is said, maintains their flesh, while their bones and vital juices are supplied by the rocks and the rains. Their thoughts and moods are directed by the coming and going of the seasons and the elements, and having such mighty ones as the movers of all their functions, they are said to be free from all the ordinary limitations and more powerful even than the gods."
"Such a strange being," observed the cake seller, "should be easy to recognize." And immediately he returned home, set his affairs in order, instructed his eldest son in the care of the shop, and the same evening left the city on his journey in search of an immortal. After many weeks upon the road, he came to a hut inhabited by an ancient personage of severe aspect, who seemed to him to be at least 200 years old. His white beard caressed the upper part of his shoes